Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider, and also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Scrum Down NBC Sports Rugby Podcast. I am your host with the most, Alex Kubiceran. It is great to be back, everyone. Lots to talk about this week's show. Obviously, reaction to round three of the Six Nations, which was across Peacock TV live in America and replaying on CNBC with myself and Brian Hightower in studio breaking it down. And it really was an exciting weekend. Three games, three competitive games. Italy surprising everyone, showing their grit against Ireland in that game and keeping it competitive and showing some real improvements at times. England-Wales was a tussle, maybe a lot of kicks and maybe not as exciting as some would have hoped, but another arm wrestle test match where I think you're starting to see the growth and improvement in this England side and the framework of what Borthwick and his MO and what the sort of DNA of this team is going to be going forward. And what's exciting is they've still got a lot of room to grow. Where contrast that with Wales, you know, warning signs there. One try only coming from an intercept. You know, that's only three across the whole tournament. They have really struggled on converting chances. And for Warren Gatlin and them, it doesn't look like there's a light shining out the tunnel yet. And they still need to find identity, as constant selection changes have not reaped the rewards that maybe he would have liked. You know, a new sort of 10 centership partners, but still the same old issues of not being able to create and wondering where to go from now. And then lastly, France and Scotland had an absolute cracker in Paris. You know, two red cards, which, you know, added a little bit of drama, but luckily, you know, both teams had to suffer with a forward down, which I say luckily, not that there was head contact to players, but just for the spectacle of the fans, that we didn't get a lopsided event. Scotland were 19-0 down at one point. The ability to come back and make that competitive. But I think the big story for them is just too many missed chances. And, you know, to get into those games and get some more of the numbers, the analysis, the real detail, we've brought Ross Hamilton back, who's performance analyst, who works with all the TV broadcasts on preparing a lot of, you know, what they're presenting on, what the detail is, and really analysing these teams and the key numbers and stats that, you know, lead into the matchups. But where I think he's fantastic is his game analysis and actually sort of depicking these games through the numbers. So to get through that and get sort of all the breakdown of those games from a numbers point of view, we have Ross Hamilton back on, and then we're going to have Chris Jones from the BBC on. We'll talk more big picture Six Nations topics, react to some of the news in the England camp, where the teams are at, talk more of the stories off the field in the Six Nations and the big picture stuff going on in the news. But for now, it's time to get into round three of the Six Nations by the numbers with Ross Hamilton. And we are joined again by the returning Ross Hamilton, the man with the numbers. And Ross, welcome back to the pod. An exciting weekend of rugby we had.
Yeah, thanks for having me again. Enjoyed coming on. And yeah, you're right. We just said before this, as we introduced ourselves, was it's great, isn't it, to have three decent games of rugby every weekend, with Italy being genuinely competitive. It's so interesting and entertaining to watch all three now. Typically, with just one dead rubber most weekends, you've only got two, but it's brilliant. And the rugby on the weekend showed that, I think.
No, absolutely. I think just competitiveness across the board, the fact that, you know, there was atmosphere in every game, you know, Ireland, Italy showing that competitiveness. England-Wales was exciting, even though maybe not the most open game at time. I thought it was exciting. And then lastly, France, Scotland didn't disappoint over there as well. And I think, you know, from a fan point of view, we're blessed. You know, from a tournament point of view, it's sad that potentially, you know, Scotland weren't able to keep their unbeaten run as they face Ireland at Murrayfield coming up in the next round. But really, you know, that game still has huge implications because if Scotland are able to get it done, you now have it could go any way of sorts with this competition.
Yeah, the title's still open, isn't it? Obviously, Grand Slam lost for Scotland, but only technically still on for Ireland. But if Ireland slip up, then there are genuine chances for France, for England, for Scotland to still come in and win it.
Absolutely. And we'll get into next week previewing those games, as I'm sure there'll be some numbers that, you know, paint a pretty good picture. But let's get into this weekend's games and the ones we've just had. And I think we'll start chronologically. We'll start with Ireland, Italy. You know, Ireland on paper, bonus point win, job done in Italy. But it wasn't as, you know, one-sided as people might have expected.
No, and sort of to touch on my point earlier, that Italy were genuinely competitive, and I think they were, and the numbers suggested that. There were a few areas where they sort of slipped up a little bit, let themselves down a little bit, maybe in the last areas of the game. But attacking-wise, I think just from the naked eye, they look better. Their shape looks really great, and some of the numbers proved that as well. They made beat more defenders than Ireland beat. They beat 24 defenders to Ireland's 18. They made more offloads. They had a better collision success than Ireland did. So dominating a collision in the carry, 41% of their collisions were dominant compared to 25 for Ireland. So they had the sort of the basics there, and their attack was pretty good. There was just a couple of areas for me that sort of showed up with the stats where they didn't quite convert. And that came because they made too many errors. They had Ireland made 7 breakdown steals compared to just 1 from Italy. And then we look at something that we call positive outcomes. So we can sort of quantify a possession of a team and how well they execute what they're trying to execute, whether they made an error or not. 40% of Italy's possessions ended in an error. So you just can't go 4 out of 10 possessions, turning the ball over, conceding a penalty, kicking away aimlessly. It just won't give you that final product. And then I did have a look at that as well in terms of the red zone is something we look at all the time and talk about of how teams convert their chances and really get the scores on the board. Italy had 16 entries into Ireland's 22. The most of the weekend, the most that any teams managed against Ireland. Ireland themselves only had 12, but they just couldn't convert that into points. Their conversion rate was 1.06 points per entry. Only 19% of their entries did they score a point of any kind. And if you contrast that to Ireland, to give you sort of a benchmark, their points per entry or their red zone efficiency was 2.58 points per entry, and they converted 42% of the time. So that's the difference. Ireland didn't play probably as well as they could have done. They made a whole host of changes, Shaw and some players out injured as well, but they still managed that. Italy played well, looked great, just couldn't get that final level. And they threatened as well, but they just couldn't do quite enough.
And, you know, we talked about sort of what's quite remarkable is Italy were really struggling to get those red zone entries. You know what we talked about? And, you know, to get 16 against Ireland, predominantly a lot of all their play before and their points had come from set piece entries or launches off set piece down there. And what I thought was impressive is what I called on NBC is like the Garbisi effect and having that 10 out there that could allow them to play. And they had much more shape in that, say, maybe 40 out moments where they were actually breaking the line or actually creating, you know, overlaps on the edge or opportunities. And to me, that was a huge change and maybe what we've seen from Italy in the first couple rounds.
Yeah, I probably agree with you. And you're right, from 40 in, they did really well. They made some line breaks. They made 6 line breaks against an Ireland defence. They got into the 22, 16 times, as we said. So they certainly had that element to it. I did actually have a look at sort of Garbisi and him coming in because who is he as a 10 and compared to Tommy Allen? He's probably not a game controller. He's a game breaker. He can set up those line breaks. He can make them himself and he can go and score those tries. But they perhaps didn't have quite this game control that you might have hoped for from a top level team that are going to win more games. And just some of the stats to sort of highlight that, potentially linking to Garbisi a little bit and his game control, was Ireland had 62% territory. So 62% of all of the game was played in Italy's half. And I also then had a look at how Italy managed that themselves. So I looked at their possession. Italy had over 10 minutes of their own possession within their own half, which means that 60% of all of their possession was in their own half. So when they got 40 out and into the 22, they were good, and they could get into those areas, and they sort of flashed quickly, didn't quite convert them off of the back of that, but just far too much play within their own half, not really stressing Ireland's defence where it counts. So then when they got into the 22, they couldn't convert, couldn't break them down because they hadn't done it in the right areas. And just one final one to link into that, they kicked the fewest of any team so far in any single game, just 19 kicks in play. Garbisi only had 5. Stephen Varney, the Italy scrum half, only had 6. So that game control element where they place themselves into the right areas, of which then to strike perhaps wasn't there. If they did that a little bit better, we've shown that they have the attacking ability to do something, just need to be a bit smarter perhaps.
Fascinating stuff. And I think it's cracking insight to get some of those numbers into a game that, you know, it all just adds layers to what you're seeing. And I think it's fantastic. So let's wrap that game up there. And let's look to the next game of the weekend, which was England traveling to Cardiff. Most of the talk in the week and the drama had and the build-up was off-field drama leading to this game. But then once we actually got to the game, it wasn't a bad test match at all. I think the same old issues for Wales is one try, and it was, you know, an intercept try. You know, that seems to be really their sort of, you know, unraveling in this tournament is an inability to convert and put points on the board. What did you make of it from sort of a numbers point of view?
Yeah, I think you're right. Probably wasn't the best spectacle, maybe as a neutral fan. I do agree. So it was a great test match. England certainly improved. I think they're adding layers again. We talked about where they were starting from, set piece and so on. And they had this first phase move that they then scored with Anthony Watson out the back in the second phase, which was fantastic. And that's good to see those layers coming in. And you're right, for Wales, for me, in terms of the numbers, they're just too much of the same, really. One of the big ones I looked at was the ruck speed. We look at this all the time in everything these days. But Wales had the second slowest ruck speed of any team in the tournament so far in any game. England was the third slowest. So as a contest, the ruck speed was just really slow across the board. No team really got that dynamic play where they could go and create chances off of the back of it. Didn't quite work out that way. But I think it mattered more for Wales. As you said, the only try they scored in that game was a Louis Rees-Sammet intercept. They only had 4 entries into the red zone, into England's 22, 4 in an entire game. One of them was an intercept. The other 3, 2 ended in a penalty and 1 ended in a turnover. So what are they creating in attack? Nothing is maybe the answer to that. Unfortunately, 1 intercept, yes, it was great from Louis Rees-Sammet, and obviously you're not going to catch him once he's away. But they didn't create anything themselves. There wasn't anything that they could build on. And the other thing I wanted to sort of touch on that with their ruck speed, when they get such slow balls. So some of their numbers weren't too bad in terms of comparison to England. Made very similar amount of meters. They beat more defenders than England did, for example. They made more offloads. Their collision success, gain line success was almost identical. So if you look at that on paper, you think, well, they're there in the game and they should be able to do something with it. But that slow ruck speed, which did affect them, I think, more than England, perhaps because of their kicking style, didn't allow them to get into the 22 for one. But what it meant for England is when you have a slow ruck, you give the defence more time to organise and get set, get your line speed, get square, get off the line and go and make a hit. England did that. They made 18 dominant tackles to Wales 8. So, I mean, 10 more is huge. It is a huge difference. And, I mean, Corbs, you'd attest to this. If somebody goes and makes a dominant hit on you, the momentum of your attack is almost gone straight away, just with one, over the gain line or before the gain line, depending on where you're looking at it. And you have to resort to sort of kicking the ball away, or you continue fighting for not much ground. And I think that resulted as well. If I looked at some of the numbers for Wales kicking, typically in the tournament so far, their nines, their scrum halves, have kicked 6 times in a game. So they're both depending on the replacements. And their tens was 10.5. The fly halves kicked 10.5 times. Versus England, their nines kicked 17 times. Their tens was the same, about 10 as well. So they've gone over nearly 3 times as many kicks from 9 as they've had done in average per game in the rest of the tournament, because slow ruck speed, dominant hit, no momentum, can't go anywhere, got to kick the ball away. And that just seemed to be the case continuously for Wales, unfortunately.
Fascinating. It's been a struggle for them in this tournament, and it's crazy. You know, Gats coming in and Pivak looked like he was struggling, and you know, you got the most winning successful coach in Welsh history coming back in his 0-3, and without any real sign of like, you know, a turnaround on the horizon. Where you contrast that with England, who, you know, I think are ever improving. You're starting to see more of the framework of Borthwick's England, this team, pragmatic, the way they use set piece, much more physical this week, I thought, as well, in a lot of areas. Genge's carrying as well, just incredible. I saw some of his Opta stats. You know, he's averaging something like 20 gain line carry, positive gain line carries a game or something silly, which is just like we're talking about the effects that has on your game. You know, I don't think England looked as flash as they potentially could be in attack, like when they get going, or maybe, you know, they're playing a little bit risk averse at times, but some real bright sparks, and you can see that the actual set piece as such is really starting to turn a corner as Borthwick sort of put that focus back on the side. What do the sort of numbers say for England and across the board?
Yeah, for me, your point there, so the risk averse style was still quite clear, I think, and it was very much a Borthwick-Leicester kind of game plan, and we touched on this, that I definitely think the shape as well from England's attack looked there. Some of the analysis that I looked at over the weekend showed that they had opportunities which they didn't quite take. So we talked about their gain line success and their line breaks and so on, and their red zone entries were better than Wales's. But they had more chances. They could have done even more for me. There were opportunities where they could have played out the back and could have played to space, and they were just a little bit too tight and maybe hit that first option too easily. Similarly with their kicking style, it was perhaps even more prevalent the week prior, the game prior, where they got into sort of real attacking areas and then still kicked away. And if that works and that's a genuine attacking game plan, fine, but it didn't seem to be. It didn't seem to be linked up. And some of the numbers to reflect that as well about how the teams had to play, both in this case for Wales and England, was they kicked away the ball on 72% of all of their possession. Now, typical numbers might be around 40, 50%, something like that. No team has kicked away their possession more than 72% in the tournament so far. So I think there's just maybe a little switch that they can flick, that they've got into the right areas. They, England in this case, if we're talking, they have the chances and they were there to attack with, and they just have that handbrake that comes on where they kick the ball away. Wales sort of had to do that because they weren't getting any success in attack themselves. But yes, I think it was another development for England and another layer. Maybe we see another one in a couple of weeks' time.
It's a tough one, isn't it? Because Borthwick won the tournament with sort of the most kicks. You know, that was sort of Leicester's DNA. And then that makes me sort of follow up. When you talk about Wales having to kick a lot more than usual, a lot of that is a reactionary or an effect of, one, we talked about gain line, slow ball nullifying. But two, when a team's kicking to you a lot and keeping you sort of down in your end with those kicks, you have to kick back as well, which makes you having to play into England's game plan more, which is kind of Borthwick-Leicester MO, as they sort of drag you into their sort of game where they feel more comfortable winning those sort of games, as they back the defense, they back their set piece, they back the control, and then they feel they'll take their chances enough to be ahead.
That's really interesting, Cubs, because you're absolutely right. And just from some of my other work in a premiership, looking at this kind of stuff from last year and this year, spot on. Leicester kick the most and their opposition kick the most back to them. If you kick it into their territory, they can't always play from there, so they have to kick it back, which might not be their game style, and they get drawn into Leicester's game style in that case, and what we might have seen from England. However, looking at Leicester this year, they aren't the same force that they were. They're not in the top four of the table. They're possibly not going to qualify even for the final stages. Borthwick was a huge influence of that for at least half of the season with Kevin Sinfield still. And what I think I saw and what I sort of shown with some of the data for the Premiership is that teams have stopped kicking the ball back to them. If they've sort of almost gone, well, if you're going to kick it to us so much, we're going to play with it. We might make an error. We might make a mistake. We'll have to deal with that. But you're going to give us the ball so much, we're going to play with it. And it seems to then have resulted in better performances again, Leicester, where they can get wins. They score more tries and score more points against the Leicester defence than they did last year. So maybe if that translates it, without giving some secrets away for anyone listening to this, how to play against England, which we obviously don't want. But if a team recognises that, okay, Jack Van Portfleet, Leicester 9, he's going to keep kicking the ball to us. We're going to have all of these attacking platforms that we can then use. maybe there's something in there that they can do something similar as Premiership teams have done to Leicester, maybe flip the switch for them. And if it's France and Ireland in the last two games, play with the ball a lot more.
I agree. Well, mate, France and Ireland are two dangerous teams on the counter. So, you know, that's the risk reward. I think you got to pick your moments, pick your chances. And the thing is, I think Ireland and France both have a pretty decent kick run sort of decision-making back three that you know, will make those sort of outcomes and those contests pretty interesting.
Have you ever brought your magic to Walt Disney World like, hey, we came to play? Did you tip your tiara to a Creole princess or get goofy officially? Step up like a boss and save the day? Or see what life's like under the Tree of Life? Did you? If you could, would you? When we come through, it's true magic. 'Cause we came to play. Bring the magic at Walt Disney World Resort.
Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Let's get on to the last game of the weekend and the sort of the big contest in Paris, which saw a Scotland side, in my opinion, create more than enough chances to put France away potentially on their own patch. We talked about them being the most accurate team in the tournament coming in this weekend. I think it was always going to be fascinating because both those teams don't usually focus on a lot of possession in games. And so it was, to me, fascinating who was going to hold onto the ball more and who was going to take that initiative. And it was Scotland trying to play that sort of game. But unfortunately, they couldn't break France enough. They squandered a lot of chances. And you also have to credit the French defense for you know, fronting up and nullifying some of those chances, where I think France, you know, took enough shots to get ahead, to stay ahead. And, you know, you kind of saw positive sparks from both teams in that game.
Yeah, I think it was interesting that France went 19-0 up. Obviously, the red cards perhaps nullified themselves just about in time, but France still went 19-0 up. So Scotland had to then go and play. I don't think they could have employed their previous tactics of kicking the ball away and then trying to convert when they got those chances. They just wouldn't have done enough, which was amazing to see that they have that ability to sort of almost go to a plan B, depending on what's happening in the game, and flick something else. It's something we haven't seen from England perhaps for a long time. And what was different was that they had so many opportunities. They had so much more possession. They had, you know, the territory, the field possession, everything. But they didn't convert like they had done. We mentioned it last week, and I said perhaps I hadn't given Scotland credit that they were playing a very smart style, but the risk was they couldn't maintain those levels. They averaged over 4 points per entry in both of those last two games they played, and that's extraordinary numbers if you were to maintain that through a tournament. I've never seen that before. So it would have been a big ask for them to go and do that. And I think some of the numbers I've got sort of shown how they increase their possession and their chances, but they decrease their conversion rate. So some of the numbers, again, overall territory, Scotland had 61% of the territory, so playing in France's half. The possession in opposition half of Scotland, again, for their own possession now, was 72% of all of their possession in France's half. They played there. They played there for a long time, nearly 14 minutes. That's not far off some teams' total possession time, and they played 14 minutes in France's half. Time in the opposition 22 was 7 minutes compared to 5 for France. So they had a lot of possession, a lot of pressure in the right areas, but they didn't quite convert them like they did. And just to sort of finish that off for numbers-wise, 13 red zone entries from Scotland, 11 from France, and their red zone efficiency this time was 1.62, down from 4. And again, to give that sort of some kind of context, France were at 2.64, so just over 1 point extra per entry. So if Scotland could have got there, just 1 point better up to the level that France were, let alone up to where they were 4 points per entry, 1 point per entry times 13 entries is 13 more points, and that's the game. And it's just those small margins, tiny margins and tiny numbers. When you look at that thinking just 1 point per entry doesn't seem like much, it adds up and it makes a big difference.
I always say small margins decide big games, and that is literally one of them there. And I think, you know, from a France point of view, 19-0 up looked like they were in control, but numbers-wise, how did France perform compared to normally?
One big thing that I saw from France, which I think is interesting, whether everybody else does, a different, quite a different matter. But ruck speed, we talk about it all the time. There are two elements of it, though, which maybe we haven't touched on before, so this might be something new. Average ruck speed obviously takes across the whole game. It includes everything. When you're setting up for a box kick, those are potentially a little bit longer, and they get included into your average. France had an average ruck speed of 4.38 seconds per ruck. Scotland's 3.32, so over a second faster every single ruck they had. So if you look at that thinking, well, Scotland had a much better attack then. They had the front foot and the momentum. But a key number that we look at, and we talk about this, and everybody's talking about this kind of number, is rucks under 2 seconds. 2 seconds is the margin that certainly we did look to this for England when I was analysing them as the number that you want to achieve that gives you the best chance of creating disorganisation in defence, that creates chaos, and then you can go and make some line breaks and convert off the back of that. France had more rucks under 2 seconds than Scotland did. 34% of all France's rucks were under 2 seconds. Scotland's 28. So Scotland's still quite good. But when you think that they had a second slower average ruck speed across the whole game, and yet they had a higher percentage of rucks under 2 seconds, you've got to think, well, where's that come from? And for me, it was that they set up their kicks and they played in the right areas. When they need to go slow, they played slow. But when they go fast and when they attack, they are lightning. And it's that switch again that they switch on, and they just undefendable.
It's like that first try they scored, like just big forward carries, gain line, quick ball. It's just they flexed early against Scotland, and you know, I was like, oh man, like if they play like that and they get that quick ball 2-3 phases with those forwards in the 22, it's game over when Dupont and Intermac get the ball. And you know, it's fascinating how France, you know, can turn it on. But again, like this Six Nations compared to maybe where they were last Six Nations, there's a definite drop off in the sort of overall performance of the team.
Yeah, I agree. I think they still obviously have the capabilities and the abilities and the tries that they scored are evidence of that. And with those sort of numbers, you know, they're just playing smart, don't need to play that much in their own half, play in the right areas, slow the ruck down, kick it away. Then when you get the ball, when you get a turnover, absolutely come alive, tear the teams apart, quick ruck speed, and you're not going to be able to defend a France when they've got Damien Penno and Antoine Dupont on the ball all the time. And one final thing, sort of a France and a Scotland look at this was how clinical they were with the ball and how sort of effective they were with their skill sets. And where Scotland maybe fell down quite significantly was handling errors. It was a big stat that jumped out at me. France only made 2 handling errors in the entire game, which is frightening kind of stat. An average, you'd be looking at, if you'd be doing really well if you were less than 10. It was a very similar sort of a discipline. So to have just 2 is crazy. And unfortunately for Scotland, they made 17. So if you look at that as a picture just in itself, it kind of says everything. Scotland played a lot. Yes, they had great pressure, great possession, great territory. Too many errors, couldn't convert. France, the exact opposite.
Fantastic, mate. I think that sort of summarizes the games up great. I really appreciate you coming on. I think it's great insight to be able to hear your stats, ask questions, and then maybe add some context or thoughts to it as well. So, mate, we'll definitely have you on again next week to do a little bit of preview before next week's rounds. But thanks so much, Ross, and we'll speak soon.
Brilliant. Thanks, mate.
So good to have Ross on always. I think it's an absolute asset to this pod to get some of that detail and numbers into it. As I know, a lot of our diehard listeners are absolute rugby nauseous like myself. So thanks for all your support. But now it's time to get into our sit down with Chris Jones from the BBC to talk more big picture Six Nations topics. And we are joined by the returning Chris Jones from the BBC. Chris, mate, welcome back to the pod. How are we going?
Good to be back. Yeah, going well. 3 weeks down, 2 to go, shaping up nicely the Six Nations, and loads to talk about as always.
So much to talk about, and we're going to get on to England. I got some stuff that I definitely want to talk about there. But when we look at last week, we kind of recorded the pod on Monday, doing a lot of our previews towards the weekend. And then all hell started to break loose with the off-field drama of Wales, the player potential strikes, the crisis meetings. What a crazy sort of storyline to sort of add into the mix with one of these exciting Six Nations and what's going on the field as well.
It was surreal, wasn't it? Because I remember thinking on the Thursday when the teams were named and we started to talk a little bit about rugby, you know, the usual chat about matchups and team selections and tactics. And we were doing that on the Thursday before the game, when normally that would have started, you know, a fair bit earlier, especially with the Fallow week. People would have started to stir the Wales-England pot, started to, you know, look at, you know, pundits chucking a few bombs this way and that just to stoke the fires. But instead, all the focus from pretty much the Thursday of Fallow week, when Alex Bywater from the Daily Mail dropped that bombshell story about the strike threat, through to the Wednesday night, the game was under a cloud. We weren't sure it was going to go ahead. And I know a lot of people may have thought, oh, it was always going to get sorted. And yes, that was probably the instinct, but the players were deadly serious. And I think they're still serious. And I think there is still a bitter level of animosity around Welsh rugby from certain people to other parties. The thing is nowhere near sorted. It was great that we got the game on, but the problems run deep in Wales, both on and off the field.
It's pretty spectacular that, you know, the national team players did sort of, I don't know if you say step up or hold ranks together like that for the overall playing population, which I think is quite impressive when you think about it. Because sometimes when you look at England, there's been times that I've always wondered if the players would hold their ground, but potentially, you know, 20 odd grand at Twickenham on the weekend's a lot to risk by potentially not playing and standing up for maybe people that it doesn't affect you as much, where these guys, I think they're all in the same boat in a lot of ways, but to have your national team sort of hold out like that, especially the week of England, Wales, all that's going on off the field, like, you know, it's very impressive from the player side, but then from the coaching side, you must be having an absolute breakdown as well.
Yeah, and this is the thing. People were saying after it was all sorted on Wednesday, oh, look, it'll bring the players close together. And it may have done. And I think the players were quite a tight bunch. I don't think they were all completely, you know, no one agrees on everything. You're never going to get how many 30 plus people in a national squad completely with the same views. But on the whole, they were pretty united in solidarity. I think when it came down to it, you would have had a different level of militancy, if that's the word, between player and player. That's to be expected. But this was a Wales team that was struggling on the pitch to the extent that I don't know if just being motivated and being bonded together was going to mean they could beat England.
Obviously, I think these issues are not solved yet, and that's going to be ongoing and lingering. And there's been, you know, articles coming out, I was reading today, talking about Cardiff players and different players who are being told, some of them are on up to 200,000, that, you know, it's a 30 or 40,000 pound contract, which is not laughing. It's just ridiculous at how that's actually going on. Like, I think one of the issues to me is that they're just going to have to let, if they can't pay the lads anywhere near market value, they're going to have to pick the guys and let them play abroad again. And I know it's been compromised at 25, which probably is a fairer one. But, you know, like, what's the solution? That they get held to contracts in Wales as the only main viable way to play for the national team. And you look, like, the Welsh regions, they're all over the place from where they were, say, maybe like a, you remember the days of Ospreys and Scarlets had their rise. They're just nowhere near that anymore in that same sort of level and sort of structure as they've been.
Yeah, and you look at a few vintage sides, Cardiff, I think the Cardiff side that won the EDF Cup in 2009, when that Anglo-Welsh thing was quite a big deal, a cup to win, likes of Andy Powell and Jamie Roberts and a young Lee Halfpenny, Shanklin, Tom James, really good team. The Ospreys side of a few years earlier with, you know, world-class players mixed in with the core of the Wales team. You know, you saw all those Wales team that beat England at Twickenham in 2008. And then the Llanelli side that won in 2017, the Pro 14. But then straight away, lost Tyke Byrne, lost John Barkley, and lost a couple of players that were instrumental to their success. So it's just not been a picture for the last however long of long-term sustained success. And I think what you're seeing now, or you're hoping, the penny is dropping in Welsh rugby, and you can't just have a top-down approach where as long as you can cobble together 15 good players for the national side, fill out the principality, Sim Hings and Arias, get the job done over Six Nations rivals, everything's rosy in the Welsh rugby garden. That's not working. That may have worked for a period under Gatland when he had a brilliant crop of players and managed to foster a Team Wales environment, but not anymore. So, big decisions have to be made. And I do think we're going to be having the same conversations, less drastic measures are taken, whether that is it's cutting a region down to three, whether it is the Welsh regions playing in a different competition away from the URC and trying to join the PRL. There are drastic options that are being considered, but they are still some way off. And it feels at the moment as if they're trying to get through this six-year deal with smaller squads, lower salaries, not recipe for success when you look at the quality of Leinster and the South Africans. So you fear the can is just going to be kicked down the road a bit in Welsh rugby.
Agreed, mate. And, you know, it's going to be an uphill battle for them. It'll be interesting to see them travel to Italy as well and how that
goes. Wow, who's your money on there?
I need to look at the stats a little more. But
yeah, of course you do. Yeah. No. But no,
it's the first time no prediction I'm not yet. Saying Wales. It's the first time I think you could ever tell me I'm not saying Wales. Listen, I wouldn't be going a big spread and I'd probably be thinking it's going to be reasonably close. You never know. It might be the exact game that Wales need to kickstart themselves. But my instinct is I think Italy are actually looking quite good.
Yeah, they are.
I think
they
with Garbisi at 10, they were way better and played their way into the 22 for the first time in the tournament, which I thought was massive, which we talked on earlier in the pod. But yeah, it's not looking good for Wales. And, you know, it could get worse. Hopefully it gets better. But like we said, there's some serious issues that need to be addressed. Now I want to get on to England. And lots of stories going on here. I think England are an improving side. I think you can see the footprints of what Steve's trying to do with the team, the new identity, where they're trying to go. The big story that's been getting on social or so today on and everything, which is Tuesday, is Marcus Smith getting released back to Quinns for the big game and George Ford coming in with the idea that he will be the other 10 against when England play France. And what do you reckon of that call and what have you heard?
Yeah, so as soon as you see Smith out, Ford in, it's got everyone talking. You know, I've not seen England fans as animated about just a straight training squad news story as this for quite some time, because it's more, to a lot of England fans, it's more than just a personnel choice. It's a kind of attitude, environmental, cultural choice about style, ambition. You know, people would see Smith in the kind of cavalier corner, the dasher, and Ford and Farrell in the more prosaic, conservative corner. There's nuance to that. And this doesn't mean that Smith's not playing against France. I think it probably means he isn't playing against France, because I don't think it's Borthwick's style. I think he's such a planner. I don't think it's his style. If he's got someone who really sees being a big part of his 23, him sending him back to Quinns or to his club.
Yeah.
You know, this is the big rebuild. Every second on the training paddock is huge for Borthwick and his coaches at the moment. So if he still sees Smith as his bench 10 against France, I'd be very surprised if he's sending him back. So my interpretation of this, which is the obvious reading between the lines, is that I think it does mean that Farrell and Ford are in the matchday squad and Smith isn't. There's a very slim chance Ford and Farrell play together and Smith's on the bench, but if Ford and Farrell play together, he's got the chance of playing a 6-2 bench because of that versatility. And look, who knows? Smith could have a blinder. Borthwick could have a look at Ford and go, he's not quite ready yet for a return. And we're back where we were with Farrell starting and Smith on the bench. But I think Smith is finding himself in a tricky situation here through no fault of his own, but just because A, Borthwick is stripping back the game plan, which he's been candid about. He said it's going to be a simple, straightforward game plan at the start. And B, he's got the captain playing 10, and the other 10 is an 80 capper who won the premiership with the head coach. So Smith is up against it here. You know, it's not, people are going to look at it and go, oh my God, this means that boring Borthwick, same as Eddie Jones. Why don't we play some rugby? Why don't we attack like Scotland and Finn Russell do? But that's because Finn Russell is so far and away Scotland's best 10 that Townsend has had to, and maybe a bit reluctantly, Corbs, Townsend's had to give him the keys and said, run the side. But Borthwick has made the call that Farrell is going to be captain and Farrell's going to play 10 the last two games. And he's got to fit again George Ford, who he rates. And you can't not rate George Ford because he's class. So Smith is suddenly finding himself number three. And I think it would perhaps need a head coach to come in and go, right, Marcus, you're my 10. I'm going to give you all the tools you need. Big 12, lightning fast 9, big forward pack, run the team. That's not happening. It's not going to happen under Borthwick, at least not at the start. So fans of Marcus Smith, I think, are going to be disappointed. It doesn't mean he's doing anything wrong. It doesn't mean Borthwick doesn't rate him. I just think for Borthwick's game plan, Farrell and Ford fit it better.
Yeah, I agree. I think you hit the nail on the head. Like, he is implementing the style of play that Leicester used last year to win the tournament. And the key linchpin, and probably what Leicester have missed a fair bit this season, and in sort of some of the success of that, is having a George Ford at 10 that knows that game plan inside and out, runs the helm, and hits all the KPIs necessary to be successful in that area. So for Marcus, listen, I thought this might happen sooner than it did, just because I knew George Ford had trained in January a little bit with the squad. But I agree, I don't think he'd absolutely nailed his form until maybe the last couple of weeks in that Sale team. And so for me, I always thought this was inevitable at some point, that this was going to be, it just, you know, ain't going to kick in the ball loads. Like, they're using that as a key part of their game. And I think as well, you know, Ford and Farrell can go together if you need off the bench, if someone goes down. But on a whole, it's fascinating because, you know, Lawrence and Slade and Farrell have started to find a way, but you could easily see, you know, Ford, Farrell, Slade have played a fair few tests together in a back line, and it's not a bad option to sort of to tinker with if you have it. The next thing I wanted to get your take on was just how you think England are doing big picture, and what do you reckon so far of the Borthwick era and where it's trying to go?
I think you've got to, if you're an England fan, and, you know, England fans can think what they like, but you've got to put a bit of faith in Steve Borthwick here. He did this with Leicester, and yes, he had more time with the Tigers and more time with the players and more time in camp, but he's super methodical. Actually, I was surprised that, looking back at his team selection, going with Smith Farrell against Scotland, I thought always it would be Smith or Farrell, and really trying to get that clarity at number 10, not really having trying to have too many cooks in the midfield. Maybe that was influenced by, you know, the odd injury that he had. Henry Slade's injury, but then he didn't name Ollie Lawrence in his original squad, which surprised me as well. Yeah. It feels like he's got the balance of his side right the last few weeks. I always thought he'd play Jack Willis, and he would have played Jack Willis earlier, I think, if Willis hadn't been coming back and forth from Toulouse. But England have got a jackal threat now, which they lost the last few years. You know, they've got a real jackal threat in Willis. Ludlam is suiting the way England want to play. Super work rate side. And speaking to people in the camp, they are so impressed by the way Lewis Ludlam's gone the last few weeks. Ollie Chesham's been a revelation. Ollie Lawrence has come through. We know how good Stewart is. Malin seems to be a bit reinvigorated post-Eddie Jones. So there's enough to be excited about as an England fan. There's still loads of frustrations. The kicking of the ball in the final 22, which is great if you execute. If you don't, it's just a waste of good territory. The way that they don't ever seem to put a side away at the moment. 20 points to 12 up against Scotland, lose the kickoff, lose field position, lose the game eventually. Italy there for the taking at 19-0, kind of limped to victory, but it wasn't as convincing as it could have been. Wales, what are they? They're 8-0 up. They're 15-10 up. They miss a kick at 15-10 to go 18-10, but they could have kicked for the corner, tried to kill the game. I think a different England side would have put Wales to the sword in Cardiff. But it's early days. And I think there's cause for both frustration and optimism with England. I'd love to see a little bit less fear of losing, but that might come now because they've had their big banana skin navigated in Cardiff. They've got two games now where they'll start probably as the underdogs, but they can definitely beat France. I don't think they can beat Ireland in Dublin, but I think they can make some big strides the next few weeks. So it could be better. They could and should be 3 from 3, but it could be worse. And I think they're in a pretty solid place. And kind of, I think if you're Borthwick, you're not happy, but you're satisfied with how it's all going.
Yeah, I think eventually we'll see more layers to this team. And I think really that will happen in the summer with the World Cup camp and the prep time they'll get. And then potentially a clear identity. I think some of this is built around like necessity of winning and being up to scratch early. And that's why we're forward coming into this game plan makes sense. The big question marks for me, you know, is going to be how do they handle France and the physicality? How when you get a big team in there, how do they handle that? Same thing with Ireland. You know, what can they do to offset Ireland and their game plan? And, you know, what can they do to threaten Ireland in attack? And I think those will be the ones which are good litmus tests of where it is, but also with the perspective that they've only had such a short period of time to really implement anything.
Yeah, I think the draw was set up so well for England. It's why I picked them to go to Dublin, potentially 4-from-4, just because it was so well set up with those two home games and then away against a Wales team struggling. France at home, have not won at Twickenham in ages. So look, I think they need to beat France. I think that would really salvage their campaign. I think they could lose against Ireland, lose to Scotland, but beating France at home, winning in Wales, showing signs of progression, bringing some players through. I think that's a pretty good result for England, as long as they're moving in the right direction. Steve Borthwick is all about building, all about getting blocks in place. As long as you build on those blocks, I think England fans will be patient. And this whole kind of style thing, look, they're not going to play free-flowing rugby. They're not going to play the most adventurous rugby, but not many teams really do. France kick long the whole time. They've just got a load of game breakers. Ireland are very good to watch, but they're quite structured. Finn Russell plays rugby from the gods a lot of the time, but he also kicks a lot of ball for field position. So there's always detail. I think England just need to find a USP, what they're about. If it's a high work rate side, great. If it's a set piece side, great. If it's a side that's an absolute menace at the breakdown, great. But also ruthless, accurate rugby. It's what sets the best teams apart. Style, you know, you can get teams that kick a lot of ball, but if they're ruthless, like taking their chances, like the great All Black side, the fans don't care. You know, you can only have 30% ball, 5 entries. You score 4 points, 5 points an entry, and you're 25 points to 10 victors. No one cares. So that's what England need to be. They've been profligate. They've been a little bit cagey. I think they've occasionally taken a conservative option. If they can shake that off while still playing within their Borthwick framework, but be accurate and efficient in the final, you know, in the Oppo 22, then I think there's the frame of a good side here.
Absolutely agree. I think they're a team on the upward. I still think France is a really tough ask for them. I know you think it's possible, but I just think that's a good team. It's lost one game in over a year. And for me, it's can we match their physicality? Do we have enough hitters out there to nullify those big carriers of theirs or not? I think Scotland just about managed to do that. And I think they created enough that they could have won that game. I think it'll be a great step forward for England if they can go out there and put away France or put performance together where they show that they're capable of being a team like France.
Yeah, agreed. But I think it can be done. Very interested in France 100%. At the moment. They're down to their third tight head with no Howas now, Antonio. Look, one thing Borthwick will have, Corbs, is a tactical plan to beat France.
Yeah,
you know, the guy's agreed. Too methodical. Agreed. He's too studious. So if he gets the framework and England can execute it, then I think that one's going to the wire a week Saturday.
Agreed, mate. I think it's a good place to leave it. We'll get into previews next week. But Chris, again, as always, thanks so much for your time, and we appreciate you on the pod.
Anytime, good to be here.
Fantastic to have Chris on the pod again. So much insight. Obviously has ear to the ground, being in all the media, the press days. It's just a real sort of wealth of knowledge, and a good friend of mine as well. So really grateful for him coming on and giving that insight. And that kind of wraps up the Six Nations. Reminder, you know, we had the LA Sevens on Peacock TV and CNBC across the weekend. Tough opening day with weather and stuff out there, but then the Sunday did not disappoint. An outstanding sort of event which saw New Zealand or the All Black Sevens lifting the trophy, beating Argentina in the final. But it was a great weekend of rugby, and the Sevens does continue. There's no Six Nations this weekend, so make sure that you check out Vancouver Sevens. Will be live across Peacock. The USA men's and women's teams will be in action there. Please check it out. But for now, that's all from us here on the Scrum Down. Thank you again for all the support. Keep liking, favoriting, sharing, retweeting, commenting, telling your friends about the pods, nudge them to give it a go. We really appreciate the support. Do this as a one-man band as such. So thanks for everything, everyone, and we'll see you again next week.
Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.